Higher seas in South Florida.
Higher seas and rising faster.
Welcome to the South Florida Roundup today on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm WLRN environmental reporter Jenny Stiletovich.
Today on the program, the newest predictions about how high the seas could climb and when. What is fueling the acceleration, and does it change how you and your community respond?
I'm not sure that we'll stay here. Sea level rise puts us at a higher risk here in Florida.
The new projections mean more money will be needed to help keep South Florida dry and adapt to life with more water. Could it mean we lose some places to higher seas?
Your phone calls and texts all coming up on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. For the second time in less than a week, officials are investigating a deadly shooting on a military base, this time in Pensacola, Florida. Four people, including the gunman, are dead. The shooter has been identified as a Saudi aviation student. Authorities are investigating whether this was an act of terrorism. Details from NPR's Debbie Elliott.
Authorities say they responded to an active shooter in a classroom at Naval Air Station Pensacola early this morning. Escambia County Sheriff David Morgan says deputies killed the shooter.
The threat has been negated. Our community is secure at this time. We have no reason to believe or are we looking for any additional shooters within Escambia County, not just within the parameters of NAS Pensacola.
Seven are wounded, including two deputies who were shot but are expected to recover. Naval Air Station Pensacola remains closed while an investigation is underway. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Pensacola, Florida.
President Trump's facing a 5 p.m. deadline today to inform the House Judiciary Committee if he or his lawyers intend to testify in the impeachment hearing. The panel is moving forward with drafting articles of impeachment based on the Intelligence Committee's conclusion that Trump abused the power of his office in his dealings with Ukraine. The Democrats are driving the process. The president says he's confident the GOP-led Senate will clear him in trial. Well, Ukraine still has not received a portion of the military aid that was withheld by President Trump. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports that the country is still missing $35 million in security assistance from the U.S.
The money was at the center of the House impeachment probe into President Trump. Democrats say evidence shows that Trump withheld the aid to pressure Ukraine to interfere in the 2020 elections. And they'll use that information as a basis to draw up potential articles of impeachment next week. Ukraine did finally receive most of the nearly $400 million in security assistance in September after several delays. However, a portion of that aid was not released by the end of the fiscal year on September 30th. A summary from the House Budget Committee says Ukraine never got about $35 million of that assistance. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, Washington.
The World Health Organization warns that the measles is making a comeback in several parts of the globe. More from NPR's Jason Beaubien.
The WHO estimates there were nearly 10 million measles cases last year and 140 deaths. Despite the fact that a highly effective measles vaccine has been around for five decades, global progress against the disease hasn't just stalled, it's being reversed.
In 2018, there's been an increase in both the cases and the deaths that have occurred from measles. In other words, we're backsliding.
That's Kate O'Brien, the WHO's top executive on immunization. Currently, there are major measles outbreaks in Samoa, New Zealand, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Ukraine. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.
This is NPR. As the year comes to a close, the U.S. economy is experiencing its strongest job growth since January. The Labor Department reports employers added 266,000 jobs to their payrolls in November. The unemployment rate fell slightly to 3.5%. In the same month, wages were more than 3% higher than they were a year earlier. A nationwide strike that has halted public transport and closed schools in France is in its second day. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports unions are trying to pressure President Emmanuel Macron to drop his plans to overhaul the country's pension system.
There are no protest marches today, but the metro, buses, and many schools are still closed. Public sector workers say Macron's retirement plan creates inequalities and chips away at gains made by workers over the last half century. The strike will go through Monday. Regular citizens are organizing to cope over the weekend, but nerves may fray if the labor action continues into a second week. Gilles Claudel, who's biking to work, believes the strike is merited, but says he's torn.
We will have to work more and more to have less and less pensions. On the other side, there is a lot of black blocs.
Claudel is referring to the extremists who infiltrate the union's protest marches. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Ford is recalling more than 260,000 heavy-duty pickup trucks in the United States and Canada because of a defect with the vehicle's mechanical tailgate latches. The recall covers F-250, 350, and 450 trucks from the 2017 through 2019 model years. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include C3.ai. C3.ai's software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai.
The New World Symphony performs Mozart's beloved Turkish Concerto, featuring violinist James Ennis, fresh off his latest Grammy Award win for Best Classical Instrumental Solo. Led by conductor Zhen Zhang, music director of the New Jersey Symphony, and making her New World Symphony debut, the excitement begins with Rossini's operatic overture and culminates with Prokofiev's unrestrained Sixth Symphony. December 14th and 15th at New World Center. Tickets and information at nws.edu.
Welcome to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm environmental reporter Jenny Stiletovich. We're dedicating the full hour of the Roundup today to sea level rise and climate change.
And this week we saw some new forecasts, right, Jenny, about how high the seas will get in South Florida and when. It was the South Florida Climate Change Compact that released new projections for rising seas. And the projections continue to show really an alarming trend, certainly for South Florida, higher waters and even sooner.
That's right, between 1 and 2.5 feet higher by the year 2060. That's about 2 to 5 inches more than the last time the projections were made in 2015. These projections matter because they give valuable insight. They guide local governments in their resiliency plans, like deciding how to construct buildings and elevate roads.
Yeah, raising roads, how to deal with higher tides, king tides, more water, more frequently. The state's chief resiliency officer, Julia Neschwatz, spoke on Wednesday at this conference about what the new predictions meant and when they were released.
We're going to have to think critically about the way our population centers have developed and ask ourselves difficult questions about whether our current model of growth is indeed sustainable.
We want to hear from you this hour. How much do you think about sea level rise in your daily life? How are you talking about climate change with your friends and family? And are you already thinking about the possibility of having to leave South Florida?
Planned retreat. That's a phrase that folks have been talking about and hearing about, certainly here in South Florida. What does that look like? What kind of concerns do you have? 800-743-WLRN. That's our voice line. You can join the conversation live here on this Friday. 800-743-9576. If you'd like to send us a text, you can do that too. That number is 786-786-7636. Please text us your first name, where you're texting from, and your comment. Again, the text line 786-786-7636.
We're now joined by Rhonda Haig via FaceTime audio. She's the Director of Sustainability for Monroe County and a member of the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Change Compact. So first, Rhonda, why don't you tell us briefly exactly what the compact is for listeners who may not be familiar with it?
Sure, I'd be happy to. It's a four-county entity. It's not a formal entity, but it's Palm Beach, Broward, Miami-Dade, and Monroe, who organized themselves 11 years ago to help regionally collaborate on climate issues and help South Florida move forward in climate planning events
and
projects.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so you're leading the response for Monroe County. What did you make of the new projections for sea rise that came out this week?
Well, there really wasn't a big surprise there. We've been watching the trends and noticed that they were trending higher. And when they undertook this a year ago to begin the plans for the updated sea level rise projections, we were anticipating that they were going to raise because there's been no information to slow down. It's not going on fast enough in the world to slow down the rise of sea level.
Rhonda, maybe not surprised that they were higher, but the level at which they were raised. Did that surprise you at all? Another 5 to 17 inches, is it, on the high side? That seems pretty significant move in just, what, 4 years?
4 years, yes. It was 4 years ago that we released the former projections. So, again, to me personally, it wasn't, because I've seen what's happening here in the Keys, how much, even in the last 3 or 4 years, our high, our just our fall tides have increased around the county and the Keys. So I've seen it happening. But it was a pretty big, significant jump.
Yeah, how significant does it, and what does this mean for just Monroe County, the low-lying areas?
Planning effort, well, we saw it very clearly this year. This was by far the worst year we've ever seen the King Tide flooding here in October, November, and December in the Keys. It was not only widespread throughout the Keys on the ocean side and the bay side, but it was deeper in many places than it's ever been. It stayed much longer in many of the neighborhoods than it ever has stayed before. And so me, this is just a look at what we can expect in the future, and apparently not the the not too distant future.
And so during this conference, some pretty dramatic statements were made, including by your boss, Roma Giustizi, who said some really tough decisions lie ahead, and that there you may reach a point where you can't raise roads to get to everybody's house. I mean, that's dramatic. I wonder, you know, is this something that could trigger another conch rebellion?
So so we have a lot of, you know, Roman believes in courageous communication, and that's what we plan for the summit. We need to be courageous in what we're doing down here, not just communicating. We're an island community. Our roads, our 300 miles of county roads, are at or near sea level. Of course they're going to be affected. Can we raise all of them? We don't know yet. So what we presented at the summit was just a little preliminary instant of what it could look like when we show the Sugarloaf. It's going to be expensive. It's going to be really expensive. We think we can keep up for a couple of decades at the minimum. It all depends on what's going to happen when we get this countywide roads elevation plan on, you know, in a year from now, the results from that.
So, Rhonda, let's hear some of that courageous communication that you spoke about from the county administrator in Monroe County, Roman Giustizi. Who really just put it right out there for all of Monroe County, all of Florida, frankly, to consider.
We can't just raise the whole Keys. There are some areas that just doesn't make sense. And it's that word that nobody likes to use, but we're going to have to use it more and more, and that's retreat. We're going to have to retreat from some areas, and that's going to be costly. You have to buy those lands out, those property rights, and it's going to be very expensive.
That had been a forbidden word for a good long time, Rhonda. And here you go, the county administrator of the beak of the canary in the coal mine of climate change in the United States, using it in public at a climate conference.
Exactly.
Did you know it was going to come out of his mouth?
Yes.
So take us into those conversations prior to him saying that in public. What kind of debate, what kind of weighing back and forth have you and the staff had regarding somebody in this position openly putting retreat on the table?
Well, it was an honest look at what we face here. I mean, 2 years ago, even a year ago, we thought we could perhaps elevate all the roads that we need to, but as the planning got underway for the roads elevation program and we started to get the preliminary data for instance, Sugarloaf and how expensive it might be, it became a second discussion about can we really do it all and should we really do it all? 300 miles of county roads that need to be elevated. If we don't know how many need to be elevated and when, but that's what our plan will tell us. But it's going to be expensive. We just went through a $1 billion wastewater implementation plan here in the Keys. We were comfortable looking to another $1 billion for road elevation, but now we're not comfortable at all that $1 billion is going to be enough. So we had to make a decision as to whether we can pay for it all. And should we be paying for it all? And so that's why you heard what Mr. Giustizi said. It's a good question.
And what kind of reaction are you getting from residents?
A wide variety. Actually, we've even heard from residents on Sugarloaf who agree with that that statement that perhaps we shouldn't be elevating all the roads because it's their taxpayer dollars too. And we had just the opposite reaction too. We're thinking that, you know, Monroe County government is here to protect the residents and their homes, and we should be doing what we need to do at all costs to ensure that their residents' properties are protected. So a wide variety of responses. But we've heard a lot of positive responses and a lot of people thanking us for being courageous and for stepping forward in that direction.
Retreat, adapt, reinforce, talking about climate change, some new projections that were out this week from the Southeast Florida Climate Change Compact regarding sea level rise in South Florida. You are listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. We are speaking with the Monroe County Sustainability Director, Rhonda Haig, and talking about this regional compact. And again, these new projections as South Florida here could face 1 to 2.5 feet of higher waters by 2060.
Join the conversation. How much do you think about sea level rise in your daily life? Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also send us a text to 786-786-7636. Please give your first name and where you're from in South Florida. That number again to text is 786-786-7636. You can also join our environmental newsletter to keep track of the most pressing issues. You can find that on wlrn.org/environment. Also in the studio with us is Dr. Samantha Danchuk. She's an assistant director with Broward County's Resilience Office and another member of the Regional Climate Compact. Samantha, can you tell us what stood out for you this week during the summit?
Really, it was the audience that was there. So we were joined not only by local government staff, but the state elected officials, the state staff, as well as different sectors of the business community.
Samantha, you worked on these new projections that add upwards of 17 more inches of sea level rise in South Florida by 2060. What is contributing to that? What's accelerating that?
Right. So there have actually been, in the recent past decade or 15 years, we've seen different trends in acceleration, right? It has changed. And we expect that with sea level rise, it's not going to be a smooth curve. There will be these pulses or kind of steps as we go along the way. But what's important is as we're looking at the longer record, we can really see, you know, the change that in the sea level rise that's happening here.
Can you give us a sense, though, of ice melt versus thermal expansion, just warmer water? What is it that's contributing to what contributed to the difference in the 4 years of these projections that we saw this week?
Sure. As we're releasing greenhouse gases or carbon dioxide or methane, that is essentially warming our atmosphere and warming the oceans. The oceans are absorbing a lot of that heat. As they do, they expand. And so that's causing sea level rise. Part of that is that ice is melting at a faster rate at the poles and also contributes to sea level rise. There's also vertical land movement. So there's several different things that are feeding into each other.
Vertical land movement. Does that mean sinking?
Right. So in places like Louisiana or other places where we're actually extracting fossil fuels from the earth, it's causing the land to sink. But there's also small movement in Florida, if it's an area where there's fill that's being compacted.
So talk a little bit about there are a lot of different projections out there and how you balance them and which ones you pick and choose to come up with the South Florida projections.
Absolutely. So we had a committee, a working group of scientists, of federal and local government staff that have reviewed all of the literature that's out there since the last projection. And one of the most important sources was from the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. And they released a series of curves in 2017. And part of the importance of those curves is that this time they actually produced them for regional areas. And so we were able to incorporate the regional rate of rise for, you know, the South Florida area. And so those curves were valuable because of that. And also we have more data, right? So every time we update this projection, we're able to see which curve we're following the best. And so it was obvious that at least for the last 5 to 10 years, we have been along the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the kind of 50% or the median curve of that projection. So that's our lowest boundary. And then we were able to use the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric and Administration, their intermediate high and high curves for us to incorporate as planning options.
What helps make the difference between the low end of the increase of 5 additional inches by 2060 and the high end of 17 additional inches? And I suppose this is really meaningful, Rhonda, for certainly Monroe County, right? If you're living at 16 inches above sea level today, that can mean the difference between reinforcing or retreating. So what makes up that gap?
Part of it is that the working group selected a new curve for our upper range of what should be used for typical infrastructure. And that was as a result of acknowledging that not only have we not made significant strides in reducing our emissions globally or locally, so we knew that we needed to acknowledge that it is business as usual, and it's likely that emissions will lead to the further acceleration of sea level rise. And so we selected a different curve for that upward range. And so that was the shift up. Also, the baseline shifted. So previously, the curves were referenced to 1992. Now they're referenced to year 2000. That's just part of the process. We're going to need to update it 5 years from now as well. So there'll always be reasons for small shifts within the curve. But I think what you're asking is why did we select that upper curve to be slightly higher? And that's as a result of acknowledging that the trends so far are indicating that that is a very likely scenario. And we need to, as we're investing for infrastructure that's going to be in place for 50 years or more, need to be making smart investments.
We've got a couple of experts around resiliency and climate change here in South Florida, certainly. Dr. Samantha Danchuk is an assistant director at the Broward County Resilience Office, member of the Regional Climate Change Compact. We've also got Rhonda Haag along with us, the chief resiliency officer of Monroe County. Your questions about the science, about the effect on land here on the coast or away from the coast in South Florida, you can send us a text at 786-786-7636. Again, the text line 786-786-7636. And Samantha, we did get a text from Martin in the 305 area code asking about the essentially the causes here, writing, it's not only ocean ice melt, as I understand it, a lot of water that was stored underground is pumped out. That extraction of water that's been underground for thousands of years, is that adding to either sea level rise, the water's rising, or the land somehow sinking?
So extraction of groundwater is incredibly important in South Florida for our water supply. So you may have heard of saltwater intrusion. And as we're extracting that groundwater, the sea is actually able to move further inland underwater, and that saltwater is mixing with our freshwater drinking water and is actually contaminating it. So that's why we pay very close attention to how far the sea has actually penetrated underground. Also, the salt water is intruding in our canals, right? So we have floodgates that protect our canals up and down the compact region. If those gates were open or if they weren't there, the salt water would move further inland. And so they are very relevant issues. And it's not so much that we're pumping water locally that's contributing to local sea level rise. However, it's very relevant for saltwater intrusion locally.
So, and talk a little bit more about that saltwater intrusion. What have you found over the years in Broward County? It seems like during this past week, someone brought up the fact that Broward has mapped groundwater recently. And I think just last week, Miami-Dade County is decided to map groundwater as well.
Sure. So the United States Geologic Survey, as well as the South Florida Water Management District, have a series of monitoring wells that actually tell us what the saltwater concentration is underground, and we can essentially draw a line for how far the water has penetrated there. One of the comments at the compact was actually supporting greater investment statewide for these saltwater monitoring wells and other monitoring investments from the chief science officer. They saw that as a priority. So
are you seeing movement of the line?
Of course, right? So
it's moving west.
It moves west, but as I mentioned, the gates are, in most places, keeping it relatively stable. Where you'll see it furthest inland in Broward is right around the Fort Lauderdale area, and that's because the floodgate there is the furthest west of the others. However, we are starting to see that there's seepage around the gate, right? And so you'll see these, it's obvious that the saltwater concentration is getting higher even west of the gate. In very small pocket areas.
And Rhonda Hegg with Monroe County, this is a key piece of information, obviously, for Monroe County residents and visitors, the millions of folks that come visit the Keys, because all the fresh water that comes out of the taps in Monroe County comes from the mainland right around the Everglades, and there is a desalination plant with millions of dollars that have been invested over the past several years as a bit of a precaution for additional supply when necessary. And so when you hear this kind of fresh water line, so to speak, moving for the underground aquifer. How do you hear that in Monroe County?
Oh, absolutely. We work closely, of course, with the Aqueduct Authority. They're the ones that manage that well field up in Dade County. But we work closely with them and we monitor that because it's right. It's our 100% drinking water supply here for the entire Keys. It's shipped down. It starts at a 36-inch pipe and goes all the way to Key West, and we cannot afford that. We cannot afford to have that well field contaminated. That desalinization plant they have, that Aqueduct has, is really for emergencies. You know, in the event of a hurricane, where a line is cut due to a hurricane, it is in no way enough to provide the drinking needs of the Florida Keys and our residents and visitors.
More evidence, Jenny, that sea level rise and the threat it poses to South Florida goes way beyond the coastline, goes way beyond even the canals that obviously are strung around South Florida, that is the entire region here. And that's what we're talking about this hour here on the South Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. My colleague Jenny Stiletovich is along with us as well. And we'd like to hear from you. New sea level rise projections were out this week from the Southeast Florida Climate Change Compact. Higher seas and faster coming to South Florida. How's that affecting your neighborhood, your community, your home? Jenny Vargas from Miami sent us this.
When I see those figures, it makes me wonder about whether we should continue to raise our kids here, whether we should continue to invest in, for my husband and I, invest in our careers here. We've talked about putting an extension onto our home so that we could continue to stay in our home comfortably as our kids grow. But at the same time, I wonder, is it good to put more money into this house, or are real estate values going to drop at some point because of climate change and sea level rise?
We'd like to hear from more of you. The voice line, 800-743-9576, 800-743-9576. Folks are texting in as well with their stories. You can join them at 786-786-7636. The text line again, 786-786-7636. Your phone calls, your texts still to come. The state has some money to buy out vulnerable property. What does that mean in the battle against the effects of climate change in South Florida? That's next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson.
Stiletovich, Florida is expected to face a wetter and stormier future if climate change patterns continue at the same pace. That's causing state and local officials to consider whether it's even worth fortifying the most vulnerable areas on the coast.
Yeah, the state awarded $25 million to South Florida this week to buy out vulnerable property. Monroe County got a pretty decent-sized cut of those funds, $15 million. The city of Marathon, the village of Isla Mirada, and Miami-Dade County also got a share of the money.
Would you want the state to buy your property? Have you thought about leaving South Florida because of hazards linked to climate change, including sea level rise and hurricanes? Gene Rothfield from Palmetto Bay in southern Miami-Dade County sent us this.
I'm not sure that we'll stay here for two reasons. One is that our children may settle elsewhere, our adult children. And the second would be that sea level rise puts us at a higher risk here in Florida.
Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also send us a text to 786-786-7636. Please give your first name and where you're from in South Florida. That number again is 786-786-7636. Rhonda Haig is back with us via FaceTime audio. Also with us in the studio is Dr. Samantha Danchuk with the Broward County Resiliency Office. And joining us from Harvard is Professor Jesse Keenan. He's a social scientist specializing in urban development and climate adaptation science. So Rhonda, can you tell us about, when it comes to buyouts, about 62 homeowners total in Monroe County have applied for the buyouts. How did they qualify, and how did you all help identify them?
Well, we worked with the state Office of DEO, Department of Economic Opportunity, to go through the criteria. So the properties that will receive this will be prioritized by the most vulnerable populations, and they're going to be located in low and moderate income areas that are also at the highest risk for future flooding. And yes, we did go through those applications. We're very happy about the $15 million, by the way, and we're hoping to get that grant in place by May of 2020. But I know internally we're going through an application process now so that we can process those. So by the time we get that grant, we'll be able to jump forward and help these people out.
How does this transaction work, Rhonda? If somebody's been identified, somebody wants to participate, how do you decide what the valuation is? How does the money change hands? How does this work?
Well, we're still working through the state with that. We haven't received the grant application yet. Right now we're going through the application process on how people apply. That was the most important thing, to make sure we get everybody that's interested. And by the way, I wanted to point out, this is to purchase both the land and the structure. And the good thing about it, it's at the pre-Hurricane Irma fair market value. So if these people, they've had enough with Irma, or they just want to get out without having to, you know, fix it or rebuild or whatever, you know, that's very stressful going through a hurricane and having your home, impacted, or you don't want to live here. This is a wonderful opportunity for them to take advantage of that. But we do have to go through, you know, the grant process. It's a typical state grant. You have a lot of forms to fill out, but that's what we're here to help them with.
Jesse Keenan, as you're hearing this from Harvard, you've done a lot of work on the social science here, urban development, climate adaptation, climate redevelopment in some neighborhoods as folks look for higher ground in South Florida. How do you hear this with Monroe County beginning this buyout of private property, of vulnerable properties?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I've been a longtime listener of WLRN. I think what you see in Monroe County is really tremendously positive in terms of the underlying public administration and the considerations associated with being true public stewards of public infrastructure. When you're thinking about the buyout program and prioritizing the geography as well as those who are deserving of need within vulnerable communities, low to moderate income communities, I think there's a couple of considerations that come to mind. One is, well, there's two challenges, I think, and these are challenges that are representative of across prior experience with the buyout programs across the United States. One is, what do you do with that one last person that refuses to be bought out? Mm-hmm. You may buy out 10 homes, and there's the, or 9 homes, and there's the 10th home that is remaining, and that leaves you with a challenge in terms of the underlying residual obligations, and we can talk about that.
Jesse, I call that the Up syndrome, right? If you're familiar with the Pixar film Up, the guy with the balloons and everything who didn't want to sell out, that's the Up syndrome, right?
Right. And the other component, which I think is really critical for a place like Monroe County, is like, okay, people are leaving, but then where are they going to go? And I think we give a lot of considerations to the sending zones, those areas that have the highest degree of exposure in terms of environmental exposure and socioeconomic vulnerability. But we haven't really come to terms quite yet with the underlying idea of what are those corresponding receiving zones. And when you're talking about a housing crisis and an affordable housing crisis, particularly for the service economy in Monroe County, I think we need a corresponding corresponding policy development that really thinks about higher density sustainable development that can onboard those that are most vulnerable but are also most critical to the service, and particularly hospitality in the Lower Keys. They're critical to the economy. So if it's one thing to buy out people who moved down from New York and New Jersey 20 years ago, it's in a whole nother, and they're retirees, that's a whole nother thing when you're talking about economic productivity.
Well, so Rhonda, can you respond to that a little bit about what the county is doing to deal with affordable housing?
Sure. So we're doing quite a bit. I know, you know, when we lose, especially in the Lower Keys where, you know, Hurricane Irma made landfall, and we did lose a lot of our workforce housing to the hurricane. So we're trying to, working on programs, we're trying to replace them, help them replace them with homes. But, you know, when you lose more than half your value of your home, you have to rebuild it. You have to rebuild it to current standards. And that means, for instance, if you had a mobile home or a ground-level home, you're now going to have to build an elevated home if it's in a flood zone. So that can be difficult. So I know we've undertaken a program where we're trying to issue a solicitation for tiny homes that are resilient. And we did get a good response to that original solicitation, but we are having some difficulties moving forward. We lost some of the firms along the way, and now, you know, working through some of the regulatory difficulties. But we hope it was at least a start to help with this, because we do understand we are going to need workforce housing for workers. And the county has other programs that we're already right. working with the local developers on building affordable housing for our workers.
And Jesse, let me just ask you, since you've studied South Florida, to step back a little bit and talk about affordable housing overall, because as these areas become high ground and more expensive and more desirable, what do we do about affordable housing?
Yes, it's a challenge. Land value is the primary deterministic variable of underlying affordability. So production costs are relatively equivocal, but land itself is it's the hottest commodity in South Florida. It has been for nearly 100 years.
Selling it by the gallon, Jesse. Selling it by the gallon.
Yeah, Hialeah, you know, yeah. The history is well known, and I think interesting because obviously we've reached a critical mass running into the Everglades. We haven't really come to terms with what is our infrastructural capacity, like how many more people could we possibly build for? And when we think about
a cap, right? Like, does Florida need a cap?
South Florida, I think, is running up against its capacity. And then therefore, we really need to think about infill development. And I think that will support some people will benefit from that. Some people will be burdened by it.
So let me just drill into this here a little bit. There is a cap, if memory serves right, Rhonda, on Monroe in terms of the number of residential units. Is that the right way to phrase it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
So what Jesse, you're talking about? Are you talking about a cap on buildable land or people calling South Florida home?
Well, I'm just thinking about the broader capacity of our collective infrastructure systems to handle that many more people in light of the ongoing burdens that, and particularly economic burdens that we will be faced with as we have to put money into developing resilience functionality and adaptive capacity of our infrastructure systems. So these costs are only starting to now increase. The flip side of that is we need people to pay taxes, and I don't think as a region we've come to terms with what that balance needs to be.
We get a lot of phone calls and texts. I want to get to a lot of these here. Samantha Danchuk with Broward County. We have seen Broward County residents, though, and residents of the city of Miami accept borrowing in the name of local governments with a portion of it to go for resilience efforts. In the city of Miami, it's a replacing bond, but in Broward County, it's a penny sales tax going for transportation, some of which would likely go to address some of these resilience and adaptation questions that you hear from Jesse, right?
Right, and this year, we're starting procurement on a resiliency, essentially capital improvement plan, looking at all of the needs basin scale, basin by basin across the entire county of the major capital infrastructure that would be needed to reduce flood risk.
What's on the priority list?
So related to the transportation corridors that were prioritized for the surtax, obviously, the most urgent flood risks, so areas where it's already flooding is obvious and has been documented. And looking at opportunities for us to try and either increase water storage capacity or move water from different areas. And so that will be a three-year effort. So first starting with procurement, but then 2 years to develop out that plan and the costing. And that's essential for us to be able to make smart investments. And we're talking about the amount of money that needs to be spent and needs to be spent wisely.
Some interesting texts here coming in from across South Florida. Ivan O. saying, I think about sea level rise so much, I'm selling my home and moving to higher ground. Ivan texts us, I live in a flood zone, so I'll be the first affected. He writes to us, another question from 305, if all your savings are in your home, would you recommend selling within the next 5 to 10 years or maybe sooner? Lucille in Delray Beach is along with us. She's been patient. Go ahead, Lucille. You're on the radio.
Yeah, hi. I lived 25 years on West Avenue in Miami Beach and twice paid for seawall reconstruction due to saltwater intrusion. And 10 years ago, somebody was rowing down my street in a boat. That's how much it was flooding. So I sold. And yes, I moved up to Delray, which is a little bit higher elevation. But ultimately, in 5 years, I plan on selling this and renting because it's going to be hard to sell your place and get flood insurance.
Lucille, thanks for sharing your story. So she moved out of one town with beach in its name to move to another town with beach in its name, worried about sea level rise, going to become a renter, she says. Samantha, are her concerns valid? Is that a rational economic response to the kind of threat that the science is now showing us?
So I heard a couple things that make me happy, right? One is that lots of people are thinking about sea level rise all the time, and that's inspiring action. And she mentioned that she replaced her seawall twice, right? So she's maintaining her property. That's really, really important, right? We all have a personal responsibility for floodproofing our own assets. So Broward is moving forward, hopefully right now, will be coming before our commission for adoption soon, a policy to raise our seawalls to 5 feet. By 2050, because we know by that time that's what the water level will be. And so our strategy really is to get ahead of the major flooding that's possible using the, you know, conventional engineering solutions that we're aware of, and then coupling that with additional innovative solutions. And there's a lot that can be done across the community to reduce our flood risk.
And so let me ask you, are you seeing support from the state? And I ask that because yesterday I asked Governor DeSantis about the buyouts, and he said, we don't want to see people scurrying away. They have a lot more money just from Hurricane Irma recovery funds that he says are going to go toward mitigation and other things. So how are you seeing the state come through on some of these issues?
Right. So many of the vulnerability assessments that have, you know, been done over the past 10 years were through state grants. So they have been a partner in that way. And we acknowledge now that there's a community development block grant mitigation funds that will hopefully be coming down. The state is making that application. And so those would be opportunities for local governments to essentially, once we have resilience plans, then fund the projects that are the priority projects there. So we absolutely are reliant on the state to be a partner because it is a greater lift than could be afforded by local government.
Let me bring in some more calls, some more texts as we can here. Eric in Fort Lauderdale, go ahead. You're on the radio.
Thank you. Well, I own a house right now in Fort Lauderdale, and it's the last South Florida property that I'll ever own. My parents, who are retired, have a couple of small rental properties, but very modest residential that provide them with a retirement income. Someday those will be mine, and I plan on getting rid of them immediately simply because I feel that by the time I'm retired, property ownership in South Florida simply won't be a sustainable way to have a retirement income or anything else like that.
And so a couple of quick questions here, Eric, right? Sounds like you're looking for kind of the last fool theory. I mean, you got to have a buyer if you're going to put those properties up, right? And somebody who perhaps is a bit more optimistic about the longevity of the land that you're selling.
Well, that's right, and I could find that by the time I'm ready to sell, that ship has sailed.
Yeah.
You know, although from the way building is happening now, it seems like the the last pool still hasn't arrived here.
900 people, I think, a day wind up moving to Florida, and a chunk of those certainly into Broward County. Harvard professor Jesse Keenan, what do you say to somebody like Eric, who is looking not only for himself, but his inheritance to look for a greater fool buyer?
What we've seen in the economic literature in the past 2 years, really less than 2 years, is that we know that buyers and sellers are already engaged in discounting behavior, paying less, accepting less for properties in high-risk zones. That's in the order of, say, 5, 6, 7, up to 10% discounting. There is some emerging literature that you'll be seeing in the next year associated with mortgage markets and risk premiums. And there's a real challenge ahead of us as to a broader capital economy's interest and desire to be engaged in some of these high-risk markets or collateral and financing collateral in these particularly high-risk markets. And I think one of the challenges there is how do we demarcate gradations of risk? You know, if you partition out, you can't just do it by zip code. You know, the level of precision analytically, thanks to the leadership of CROs and their offices in the compact area, we know a lot. But are we able to connect that knowledge with market participants in a way that fairly demarcates risk and the associated costs and pricing of that risk? And I think this is a challenge. So, you know, we can do a lot as a community and through our public servants, but in addressing these hazards and these risks and these long-term threats of climate change impacts, but ultimately there's another hand at play, which is a globalization of a market economy, which is increasingly aware of their long-term economic interests.
And so we got a text from a resident of one of these high-risk areas. Mary in Key Largo wrote, "We live in Stillwright Point, Key Largo. Our neighborhood streets had been under saltwater for about 40 days from September until recently. Enough is enough," she writes. "Monroe has to kick in for us ASAP." So what do you say to somebody who is sitting in a house that has been underwater for 40 days? I think it's been longer now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that comes to mind is that the question is, can counties like Monroe County ultimately afford to buy everyone out? I think this is what it really comes down to. And the criteria that we of deserving, you know, who is really deserving of these public investments and buyout programs is a critical one. At what threshold do we set it at? And at what point in time do we just simply not have enough money there's no such thing. There's not enough money to go around for universal adaptation, right?
Right.
So at some point
may be right now, right? I mean, I think the acknowledgement is there isn't enough money. But Rhonda, let me quick in our final moments here, have you respond to Mary in Key Largo? She's calling for county action in her neighborhood underwater.
Absolutely, and I fully understand why. Roman and I visited them a couple of weeks ago, and I believe we're going out again next week, and we saw what they're putting up with. It was a lot of water. It's actually 80 days in a row where they had some level of water on their roads, and that's hard to put up with. That's salt water. So what we're doing here is, you know, we got that countywide road elevation study underway. We're going to take a look at expediting the modeling for that neighborhood and see what the potential cost is. We can't leap forward with a decision right now to let's go ahead and raise the roads, because if we do it for that one neighborhood, does that set us up as a precedent for elevating the rest of the neighborhood roads?
Rhonda Haag is the sustainability director for Monroe County. Rhonda, stick with us. You're on FaceTime in Monroe County. We got a lot more to talk about. We want to thank our other guests, Professor Jesse Keenan, social scientist on urban development and climate adaptation science with Harvard University. Professor, it's always been great to speak with you here in South Florida and get your learned perspective. So we appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Samantha Danchuk, Assistant Director for the Resilience Office in Broward County, a member of the South Florida Climate Change Compact. Dr. Danchuk, thank you again for sharing the science and your perspective in Broward County with us as well. Still to come, sea level rise threatening South Florida wetlands, including the Everglades. Back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Jenny Stiletovich. We've been talking about climate change and sea level rise. New projections out this week show 1 to 2.5 feet by 2060.
Rising seas certainly putting a strain on South Florida wetlands, especially Everglades National Park. It only recently happened that the state has been calling for more funding for restoration projects.
Everglades restoration could actually slow how much salt water from sea rise gets into the marshes, combating future sea level rise across the wetlands. Rhonda Haig, Monroe County Sustainability Director, is back with us. Along with us in the studio is Dr. Tiffany Troxler. She's an Associate Director at the Sea Level Solutions Center at Florida International University.
So, Dr. Troxler, tell us what the state of the Everglades is now. We heard earlier this week, for instance, the higher and faster pace of sea level rise projections. What does that mean for the Everglades? What role with the Everglades restoration now stretching on 20 years now? What role does that play in protecting and adapting to those higher sea projections?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Really important. So, you know, we've been doing a little bit of research on trying to understand the influence of sea level rise and saltwater intrusion in Everglades wetlands. Those that were formerly freshwater and now are becoming more brackish or a little bit more saltwater showing up in those wetlands, not only as a result of sea level rise, but as a result of freshwater diversion that the restoration project is intended to ameliorate. And so, you know, what's some of the important sort of results that have come out of that work is that, not surprisingly, wetlands need water. And what we found is that when you have, you know, water that that is absent from those wetlands because of an extended drought, let's say, and you accelerate or you increase the amount of salt water in those soils, you can have an impact on those plants that are the essentially what form the soils that allow those wetlands to persist.
This is something we hear, this phrase, peat collapse. That's mm-hmm. that's what the loss of the soil. And so when you lose that soil and you lose those plants, what happens? Is that, are we talking about our water supply? Is that what comes into jeopardy here?
Well, I mean, as I, you know, the soils really provide the foundation for the wetlands that we have come to understand and through our studies, and people have come to appreciate through, you know, we have lots of tourists that come to Florida to experience the Everglades. And so essentially those soils are what provide the foundation for the habitat, provide the foundation for the plants that, you know, support the food web that exists there, which supports all the wildlife that exists there.
And the tourism dollars then.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. And so, you know, one of the, and other, you know, ecosystem services. So these are services that ecosystems can provide to humans. And so we've come to appreciate as well the protection of water supply, as well as protection of our urban environments from things like storm surge.
Right. This big sponge that's sort of sitting next to us that acts like a filter and a buffer, right?
That's right. That's exactly right.
So when you hear these projections of anywhere from 5 to 17 inches of more water than expected by 2060 compared to what the projection was in 2015, how do you hear that for the Everglades? What does it mean for that sponge that Jenny talks about?
Well, I mean, what we've come to understand is that if we can ameliorate the hydrologic effects of freshwater diversion by restoring water to those wetlands, that's even more important than keeping salt water out of them.
The more fresh water you can get in there, that's going to save those soils and those marshes.
Well, it can certainly help to save the soils, but it also helps with the natural progression of mangroves that can move into inland environments, which is very much about, you know, the evolution of the Everglades fundamentally. But what we're concerned about is that if we lose the soils to the depth that the mangroves cannot then move inland as part of that natural progression, then we're looking at potentially a sort of a landscape impact of...
You get these open water areas.
Yes. What does that look like?
You lose the marshes and you get lakes.
you get?
Small lakes. That's what some of the information is indicating. Yes.
So, Rhonda Haig, let me bring you in just for our final moments here. As you're in Monroe County, stuck between two great bodies of water, the Atlantic Ocean, of course, but Florida Bay, which of course is where the Everglades winds up. How do you hear some of these concerns from Monroe County?
For the increase in the water?
For the concerns about the increase in the water and what it means for the Everglades.
Oh, absolutely. Well, we're at the bottom of the chain, as everybody says. Everything that goes through the Everglades affects us here in the Keys. So, of course, we're very concerned. And what she said about that water diversion is very important, because I know they do need extra fresh water in certain places, but it needs to be very controlled so that they can manage the effects of it.
Well, Rhonda, we appreciate you sharing the hour with us. Lots to talk about here and giving us that Monroe County perspective. Rhonda Haig is the Chief Resiliency Officer of Monroe County, joining us via FaceTime from Key Largo, I think. Thanks, Rhonda.
Yes, my pleasure.
Appreciate it. And Dr. Tiffany Troxler with the Florida International University Sea Level Solutions Center. Great to have you back on WLRN as well. Thanks for bringing
your
perspective.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Jenny, lots to talk about here, obviously. More online and more to come, but that'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week.
The South Florida Roundup is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director.
Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations at WLRN is Peter J. Mertz.
WLRN's director of radio programming is Jason Zabka. The show's technical supervisor is Richard Ives. I'm Jenny Stiletovich.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, texting, and supporting WLRN and public radio. The program here is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.